Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, we'll talk about the land of milk, cheese, and honey. Honey that heals, milk that's illegal, and Italian cheese handmade by a Texan. I'll take you to Paris on a budget, and I'll introduce you to the burgeoning wine region in the South. I'm talking American down South. But first, let's see what's in season this week at the Southern California Farmers Markets.
This is Laura Avery with a market report. We're celebrating the new year at the market with the return of all our farmers, those who have taken their Christmas vacations. Everybody seems to be back. And, of course, we're catching up with news and trailing around after chefs trying to find out what they're cooking so we can get some great inspiration. And we've managed to catch up with Mark Peel, who is a chef owner of Campanile. He's here every single week. And, Mark, you got a big list there. Tell us what you're going to be cooking and maybe give us a recipe idea.
My favorite thing right now, and that's because it's what I'm picking out at this very moment, is Savoy cabbage.
Oh.
You think cabbage, oh my God, you think, oh, people overcook cabbage, it smells like sulfur, it smells like rotten eggs. No, no, no. Savoy cabbage is delicious, it's crisp, it's a beautiful emerald green, it makes a great soup.
Is this the wrinkly one, ruffly one?
Yeah. It's okay. The wrinkly one. It has an emerald green color when you cook it. You slice it not too thin, just like a little ribbons, a chiffonade, we call it in
coleslaw
French.
Thin.
Kind of coleslaw thin.
Okay.
Saute it very gently with just some butter, some garlic, a little bit of some onions. Till it's all softened up. Put in some chicken stock. Simmer it for about 20 minutes, half an hour. Mm. You're done.
And it's a side dish or
delicious.
Goes on
that's
with
soup.
Soup.
Soup. Put in a few fresh noodles. It's great.
So now the proportion of the chicken stock, it depends on how much soup you want.
Right.
You take a whole head of Savoy cabbage.
Yes, whole head of Savoy cabbage.
How many
I would say 2 quarts of broth.
Oh, 2 quarts, okay.
2 quarts of broth. It'll still make a nice, thick, hearty soup. And you can add things to it, some shredded chicken, some fresh noodles, potatoes. It makes like a quick and easy minestrone.
That sounds fantastic. Now, if I want to leave the broth out, because what I thought where you were going with that was just cook it till it's soft and have it as a side dish.
Oh, yeah,
you can do that without adding, you can just add less stock, right?
Right,
just
have you can add less stock, yeah. Or you can leave out the stock entirely, saute it with garlic, onions, and some thinly sliced apples. Thinly sliced apples, and then cook it down till it's soft and it's a side dish, as a vegetable.
And the round green cabbage is here as well.
Yes.
So you can see, if you spot cabbage, just go check and see if the Savoy is there. And now it's a big...
It looks like a giant corsage.
Okay, great. Okay, but...
And in a pinch, it'll do for that as well.
Okay. All right, well, that sounds really, really tasty, seasonal, and just, I can't wait to go get some and try some.
Well, I have got some. There's still some left, though.
You saved us some?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, Mark, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sounds tasty. That was Mark Peel, and he has a great recipe for some wonderful Savoy cabbage. Cabbage is a vegetable that a lot of people don't give enough respect to, but I guess done the way they do it at Campanile, it's great comfort food for these cold winter days. We're visiting now with Jimmy Williams, who is a grower who lives in L.A., right here in L.A., and he is a grower of very unique bedding plants. He grows edible gardens. He grows, I guess it's ornamental. I'm looking at this sort of sea of gorgeous things I want to stick in my yard. Jimmy is a, Jimmy, hi.
Hi, how are you, Laura?
Good to see you. And why don't you tell us a little bit about your growing program and what you do? You got stuff on the roof, in the front yard.
We have a small property in Hollywood, and we do all of this in our backyard. And we have a little terrace off the garage in the backyard, and we grow right on top of that terrace.
And what do you grow?
We grow herbs of many, many kinds, veggies, tomatoes, peppers, chili peppers, just about in every edible plant category. We grow beans. We do like over 100 different types of beans. We do over 400 different types of tomatoes. That's how crazy I really am.
So you must have some statistics possibly of what... size plot of land, say, would support a person? I mean, if, say if you did want to grow a majority of your own food, you could do that on what size of a piece of land?
Oh, you could like an 8x10. You can grow tons for a family.
Yeah.
A lot of things. If you know how to plant them, place them properly. Have your tomatoes at the back because they're higher.
Uh-huh.
And below the tomatoes, you can have your lettuce and all this stuff. You could, you know, it's kind of square foot gardening, they call it.
And so what can we plant right now?
Everything you're looking at right now, the Swiss chard, all the beets, all the chives, arugula, all the spinaches, mosh, French mosh, the Japanese mizuna, the lettuce mixes.
Okay, now I'm looking at these. Some of these look like about the size of when I would buy a baby salad mix. So if I put these in these little 4-inch pots, if I put them in the ground, can I start harvesting them to make little baby salad mixes?
Exactly. Yeah. And what you do is you never pick the center. You only pick the outside leaves.
Right.
And you can continue that for at least 2 or 3 months.
Okay.
Especially on lettuce.
Uh-huh.
Swiss chard.
Uh-huh.
That'll go for like the whole summer.
Really?
And same with the watercress.
Don't you have to have a little bog for the watercress?
No, it's called upland crest, which is designed to grow in soil, which is actually better tasting than the regular watercress.
Okay, all right. Mm-hmm. So we can do an herb garden, we can do a vegetable garden, we can do a kitchen garden.
Especially in Southern California.
Yeah, we're so lucky.
Other areas that have frost, you can't do it.
Uh-huh.
We're real lucky here.
Well, good to have you here, Jimmy.
Thank you very much.
The stuff looks really tasty.
Thanks a lot, Laura.
That was Jimmy Williams, and he's a new addition here to our Wednesday Farmers Market. He's got a wonderful array of interesting Betty plants, great variety, and a very helpful guy who can help you actually get started on your own personal garden. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Before I get too into the show, I don't want to forget to mention that I've got a new video podcast online. In it, I show you how to make a delicious lasagna with a butternut squash and absolutely no tomatoes. It's so easy and extremely yummy. Check it out. So here's an issue that people in any major city deal with: the homeless. Have you ever found yourself possessed with a notion to feed a homeless person with the food that, well, you've got on hand, like a doggy bag or the rest of your lunch? I'm going to tackle the etiquette of feeding the homeless. Beware, it might offend you. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Nobody likes it when food goes to waste, especially when we know that there's hungry people out there who need food. But just because somebody needs food doesn't mean they want just anything thrown at them that you have. Nobody likes a leftover burrito. So what food does a homeless person want? And what's the best way that you can give it to them? Helena Eichland of Chow.com actually did some research on this subject, and she's here to tell us what she discovered. So I guess we shouldn't assume that a homeless person will be happy with just anything we want to throw at them.
Yeah, that's a common assumption, I think. And I sort of became intrigued by this question because a lot of people were telling me these stories about giving food to homeless people and having it rejected. And I was like, why are homeless people rejecting food? Don't they want food? So I got this idea that maybe there are some things they want and other things they don't want, and someone should find out. So obviously, I can't interview every homeless person in America. So I just interviewed a few in San Francisco. And what I did was, I got three foods, a half-eaten burrito, half of my leftover burrito, a Granny Smith apple, and some very nice macaroons from a patisserie. And then I went to a bunch of homeless people that I found on the streets and offered them the three foods and said, you can pick one. Each pick one. And then after they'd picked it, I asked them to explain why they'd chosen that one. And it was interesting because I thought they'd all want the burrito because that was the biggest thing. But they were pretty much not that interested in the burrito. And they all nobody wanted the apple. And apparently the apple was rejected because some of them don't have very good teeth. It's too hard for them to bite into. And then they basically said they get plenty of food. They're not starving. They don't want just anything. They get in San Francisco anywhere. And I think in many cities in America, they get plenty of food at the shelters or through food stamps. So what they want is a nice treat. So the macaroons were enthusiastically devoured.
Did part of the reason they didn't want the burrito was that it had been half eaten?
Yes. They actually, one of them said specifically it's a pet peeve for him. People give away burritos a lot because they're often too big to finish. And he said that, people don't cut off the, in his words, raggedy edge. There are teeth marks. He could catch something. So he was trying to get, he told me he wanted people to start cutting off the bitten edge, which you can't always do when you have a burrito because you don't necessarily have a knife. But if you do, I think it's a nice little etiquette touch.
Is there also etiquette in terms of the way in which we give a homeless person some food?
Yeah, I was wondering about that too, because I was like, should you just leave it? I mean, maybe they don't necessarily want to engage with you. Should you just leave it by the edge of their blanket? What should you do? And I found about doing some little some research on this. I found out about this movement called Replate, and their website is replate.org. And they're trying to encourage people to put their leftovers on top of trash bins in paper bags so that the homeless people can just take them and the food isn't wasted. And I actually feel ambivalent about that movement, because I like giving the food to a person and seeing them smile and be happy.
Every time I come here to the studio, I stop at a stoplight, and there's usually an older gentleman there asking for money. And because, you know, I do what I do, and I often have food in my car, I've gotten in the habit of rolling down my window at the light and asking. So I'll say to him, you know, I have an extra loaf of bread here. Would you like it?
I think that's the perfect way to do it.
And then he was like, it was like he was shocked that I was asking. And he said, yes, we have a little relationship going now. And I find that I tend to keep more food in my car on the seat next to me now because of this. Because here in LA, we're such a drive-oriented society.
Right.
I guess basically what we need to remember, and I think what my encounter with this older gentleman did for me, was made me realize the homeless are people just like us. And like us, they like to be considered, and their feelings like to be considered when they're giving something. So you shouldn't give something in a manner in which you wouldn't want it given to you.
Right. Yeah, you shouldn't give a half-eaten burrito. You shouldn't necessarily leave it on top of the trash can like they're a stray dog. You should give them something that's nice, nicely wrapped up, and offer it to them politely.
Helena Eichland is the etiquette columnist for Chow.com. I've got links to her articles at kcrw.com/goodfood. In Texas, there's a woman making incredible handmade Italian cheese. How is that possible? Well, I'll let you know. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. With Osteria La Mozza and Pizzeria La Mozza open here in town, I thought it just might be time to explore the eponymous cheese, mozzarella. And to explore this subject with me, there can be no better person than Paula Lambert, the owner of the Mozzarella Company in Dallas. Paula fell in love with fresh mozzarella in Italy during the 60s, and she was heartbroken when she couldn't find a source in the U.S. when she returned home. So she did what any self-respecting Texan would do. She decided to make it herself. Hi, Paula.
Hi, Evan.
When you first came to decide that you were going to make mozzarella, what were some of the barriers to acceptance for the consumer for a cheese that was really soft and sitting in a pool of water?
Well, first of all, no one had ever heard of it. If you didn't frequent Little Italy in New York, no one had really heard of it. And fresh mozzarella was not on the menus of many restaurants around the country. Its advent came with the development of California regional cuisine, really, back in the early 80s. And people didn't know what it was unless they had traveled to Italy. And if they had traveled to Italy, they loved it. And so the more that people came to travel, the more that people enjoyed it, the more readily they were to accepting it.
In those early days, when I remember from my travels in Italy, at that point, mozzarella, even in Italy, had not been so industrialized that there were a lot of machines used in its production. If you went into a mozzarella factory, you would still see people forming the balls by hand, hands that could withstand the very high temperatures of the scalding water that was poured over the curd. When you first started to make them, were you doing it by hand?
We have always done every single bit of our mozzarella by hand. We still do it by hand 25 years after we began.
And why is that? Why do you feel...
Because it's a superior product. I mean, things that are handmade have great attention to detail, and not only do we have attention to detail, but we have attention to the products that go into our cheese. Like, we buy the highest quality milk, the best cultures, the best rennet, the finest of everything, and do every single bit of the process by hand.
Now, I know that your business, the mozzarella company, has expanded and you make quite a few other cheeses besides mozzarella, but what part of your business still belongs to that original creature?
Over 50%. And so it's true, we make about 20 different kinds of cheeses. Many are Italian. I've learned to make the cheeses in Italy and in different countries. But the fresh mozzarella is still our most famous and most popular cheese.
When people come to take your classes, what is the thing that most surprises them about the process?
Well, they love it. First of all, they're so amazed to see how you can just chop up this curd and pour hot water on top and then stretch it and string it. And then we also make these things that we call mozzarella rolls that we've been making for years, where you pat the mozzarella down until it's flat. And it looks like a piece of dough, and it's like you're going to make cinnamon rolls or something like that. But you spread something on top. You could spread prosciutto or chopped olives or sun-dried tomatoes, and then you roll it up like a jelly roll and then cut it off after it's chilled.
Earlier this year, you had a book come out called Cheese, Glorious Cheese. Could you share one of your favorite recipes from your book?
Well, yes, I love the recipe on the cover. It is crescenza in carrozza. And, you know, a famous, famous dish in Italy is mozzarella in carrozza. And that means mozzarella between two slices of bread that are sautéed. And the bread forms a carriage. That means mozzarella in a carriage. So I chose crescenza, which is one of the cheeses that we make. It is a wonderful, fresh, soft, gooey cheese. And you spread that between two slices of bread. And then you dip the bread in an egg batter. But instead of being just eggs, I have fresh herbs in the eggs. And then you just saute it in a little butter and olive oil, and you have this wonderful golden sauteed sandwich, sort of like a Monte Cristo. Do you remember those?
Absolutely.
Oh, I love that sandwich. Anything fried is good.
Spoken like a true Texan.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's been
You're
lovely
welcome.
Speaking with you.
Good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
The Mozzarella Company in Dallas, Texas is where you'll find Paula Lambert. She also has a book out called Cheese, Glorious Cheese. And when you think of the new wine regions of the country, are you thinking about the Dirty South? I'll be right back to let you know what kinds of wines are coming out of this region. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. We'll be right back.
If a bottle of wine from Georgia showed up on your table, would you drink it? Or would you think that southern states that specialized in moonshine have no business making wine? John T. Edge, director of the Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi, and also a columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, has been writing a series on saving southern food. He's been taking a look at the new southern wine. Hi, John T.
Hey, I'm great to be back with y'all.
What's changing in the world of southern wines?
Well, there was a time not too long ago when most of it was dreck. I mean, let's be honest. And I think that, you know, southerners need to be honest and drinkers from beyond the South need to be honest. That there was a time not that long ago when southern drink was brown drink, was brown whiskey, and that's what we did well. We do wines pretty well now. We're not there. We're not California. We're not Oregon. We're not Washington State. We're not New York State. And maybe we don't want to be.
What is it about the South that can make a wine beautiful, and what are some of the impediments to making a good wine?
Well, the impediments are many. Rainfall patterns and this kind of persistent humidity in the South. When you think about, you know, the sticky South, the humid South, you know, those things are catalysts for mildew and bunch rot. And those are the impediments. The bonus is that there are many, you know, we've all awoken to the idea of microclimates, and there are many microclimates within the South where particular varieties grow very well, whether that be Viognier and Cabernet Franc, the former doing very well, making world-class Viognier in Virginia.
Oh, that's so interesting. Now, when I think about southern grape varieties, the two that immediately come to mind, of course, are Muscadine and Scuppernong.
Muscadine.
Muscadine. Okay, Muscadine. So tell me a little bit about these grapes, which I guess we think of as eating grapes.
Yeah, those are, you know, they have that kind of foxy quality that when you think of, you know, a Concord grape or something, that hyper grapiness, that foxiness, you know, they're native grapes. They are big grapes. They are native to the Americas. Early explorers find them growing wild in the American South. And here they've long been used to make hyper-sugary wines. I have a bottle in the back of my liquor cabinet that's 20 years old, and that wine had so much sugar in that Scuppernong wine that it's become Scuppernong Port, and it's pretty good as Scuppernong Port. I grew up with a Scuppernong arbor right behind my house in Georgia. And my father made wines, went so far as to make wine labels. It said Edge's Private Stock, Clinton Cellars. Clinton was the small town that I grew up in. And three of those labels, a triptych of those old labels, is on my kitchen wall. As a Southerner, I want us to make good Scuppernong and Muscadine. It's our grape. It's, you know, it's native to our place. And there are very few, though, of this new breed of southern winemakers are focusing upon Muscadine and Scuppernong. Most are looking to European vinifera.
Do they come from the South, or are these winemakers that have come from the West Coast who are looking for a new challenge?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, one of the winemakers I really admire, the McRitchies, Sean and Patricia McRitchie, they are up in the Yadkin Valley of North Carolina, above Winston-Salem, North Carolina. They came from Oregon and saw real possibilities in that particular part of North Carolina, kind of mountainous range. They're growing a number of different grapes, including Cab Franc, Chardonnay, and Sean McRitchie will tell you with and acknowledge the incredulous response he will probably get and tell you a little bit of Pinot Noir, too.
Wow.
He's making a really good Chardonnay. I mean, one I bought a case of, would buy another case of to drink through over the course of the year. It's about $14 retail.
Now, having said that, is this something mm-hmm. that you would like to see the wine industry in the South move towards? Or since there's so much focus lately on artisanally produced southern products, are you more interested in something developed that has a more regional flavor to it?
I'm interested in both. I think they should run side by side. There's a small producer down in South Georgia on the fringe of the Okefenokee Swamp, believe it or not, Chesser Island Winery, and they are making a sparkling scuppernong, one
that
that's a demi-sec.
That must be delicious.
Yeah, it works. I mean, think about it in your head. If that muskiness is in some ways ameliorated or you know, put on a pedestal by way of the sparkles, it works.
Well, that sounds quite delicious. Nice. Give me another suggestion that you love.
I like a Cabernet Franc made by a winery up in North Georgia. The name of the winery is Tiger Mountain. The principals are the Ezard family, husband and wife. They make a fine Cabernet Franc. You get that kind of green olive but not too vegetal taste out of it. You get a little bit of cocoa in the nose. They also do a Petit Mansing, which is a fairly obscure French grape, and it's popping up on the wine lists of some of the better restaurants in Atlanta. If we all believe in the gospel of local foods, some of this education in local wines needs to come from restaurateurs. And I think there also needs to be honesty that says, you know, all this stuff isn't great. We're not saying drink Southern wines with impunity. We're saying, you know, have an adventurous palate, find the five or six you like and you can trust and you can depend upon, but drink those, support those people, because the time is now. We're no longer turning out dreck. We're turning out some pretty good stuff. You just have to look a little harder.
Thank you so much, John T.
My pleasure.
John T. Edge is our Southern correspondent. He's the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance and is a contributing editor for Gourmet and a writer for many other publications. From the South to Paris on a food budget. Not possible? Think again. I'll be back with expat pastry chef and food fanatic David Leibovitz to discover the hidden cheapness of Paris. Stay tuned right here to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. With the dollar's abysmal performance against the euro, we need different strategies to be able to enjoy Europe. A daily $8 cappuccino isn't going to make it. So to give us a tour of the best of Paris while on a budget, we turn to expat pastry chef and chocolate freak, David Leibovitz. Hi, David.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
So what are a couple of traps that you feel tourists fall into again and again and again that people should learn to avoid?
Well, one of the things you mentioned was the $8 cappuccino, and a lot of Americans come to Europe and want to act like Americans. They want to have a Coke. You know, they want to go to the Champs-Élysées and have a Coke, and it's going to be 8 euros, which is $12. And that's not how, you know, you need to come here and act like a European act. Europeans are pretty frugal. So people here, you know, they tend to eat simply. They tend to drink, you know, in cafes at the bar or, you know, order what a European would order, which sounds kind of funny. But a European would order a small coffee and sit there for 2 hours. They wouldn't order three Cokes.
Is eating or having snacks throughout the day at a cafe a good way to try and save money?
Well, my strategy, what I recommend to people is actually if you want to go to one of the chic restaurants, you know, a lot of people come to Paris with a list of restaurants and they want to go to all these sort of well-known ones they've heard about, they've read about in the Times or other places. And I say go for lunch because you can always get in. And they usually have a much cheaper fixed price lunch menu. You know, you can eat. I went to a wonderful restaurant the other day called Carré de Vosges, which is one block from the Place de Vosges, and we had a lunch that was 20 euros.
Unbelievable.
And it was, the food was, I mean, I'm speechless talking about it. The food was beautiful when they brought it out. It was like, everything was like a painting. I mean, it was really, you know, 20 euros.
Is it looked down upon when you're staying in a hotel to schlep back to your room with delicious things to eat and sort of picnic in your room?
Well, some of the hotels actually have signs, no picnicking, and that's because cheese smells. And it may not smell when you get it at the store, but when it's sitting in your room for a day or two, it does start to smell. And you'll often see, a lot of people don't look around. They don't look at the apartments in Paris. They don't look up. But you'll see plastic bags hanging from people's windows, and that's often their cheese. We're living in the world's most beautiful refrigerator.
So if you can't eat in your room, or if it's frowned upon, if stinky cheese is going to be one of your items, where do you go?
Well, you can go. There's plenty of parks in Paris, and they have benches. Parisians don't sit on the grass usually. That sort of brings up another topic. People should buy stuff that's French while they're here. Those are always going to be the good deals. Things like specialty cheeses, Spanish ham, croissants, chocolates. You know, once you can bring those back to your hotel room, or you know, people can come to my place if they've got chocolate. I'm happy to share. But those things are still a bargain here. You know, a croissant is 80 centimes, which is $1.20. I had an exceptionally good chocolate marshmallow a couple days ago that was huge. It was, you know, the size of a baby's head, and it was about 80 centimes. And I'm going nuts because I'm trying to reproduce them in my kitchen, and I can't.
Now, are there certain delis that we should go to if we're trying to save money, and certain that we might be enticed into because they're so beautiful, but we will be just stunned at the price?
Well, there's a lot of trattoirs in Paris, which are sort of takeout places. And they're all over the city, and I hesitate to recommend any in particular because most neighborhoods have one that's exceptionally good, so it's not worth it if you're staying in the 7th arrondissement to go to the 19th to go buy a slab of pâté. But even the most expensive épicerie in Paris, which is the Grand Épicerie, the big supermarket at the Bon Marché, it's very expensive and it's very chic. But I bought two slabs of pâté there a couple weeks ago, and it cost one cost 3 euros, and the other cost 1.80 euro.
Wow.
Which was lunch for two of us on the auto route the next day.
What about wine? Should we ever splurge on it, or should we assume that while in France, cheap is good?
Well, I'm not a big wine expert, so a lot of the really good stuff is wasted on me. So I tell people, you know, a lot of Americans, they don't want to be seen as cheap, they don't want to be seen as tourists. They're like, they think they have to order a nice bottle of wine. You know, if you live in Los Angeles, if you go to a restaurant, probably the least expensive wine on the list is maybe $25, $30. In France, if you spend that in a bottle of wine, you're going to get a really good bottle.
David, this has been so much fun. Thank you for our inexpensive tour of Paris.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on.
David Leibovitz is a Paris-based pastry chef, cookbook writer, and chocolate expert. I've got a link to his blog and info at kcrw.com/goodfood. Some foods are touted as having healing properties. They seem to change all the time, but right now there's probably nothing a pomegranate can't cure. But there's some scientific data to back up the power of honey, and it's something that cultures have known for generations. I'll be right back with the healing properties of honey. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Is great stirred into tea or slathered on a piece of toast. But what about slathered on an ulcerated foot or a burned body? It turns out that this ancient remedy is getting a new look as an alternative treatment. Our guest is Dr. Karen Dente. She's a doctor currently working as a journalist on issues of medical concern. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Evan.
Talk to me for a minute about the kinds of wounds that benefit from honey's healing touch.
The wounds that really benefit are chronic wounds, wounds that won't heal. We see these wounds in people with diabetes, or you could also see these in people who are bedridden in the ICU unit, or old people in nursing homes. They can get pressure ulcers, or people with burns. And these are all wounds where some of the conventional treatments just won't always work.
If wounds don't heal on the feet, what happens?
Well, sometimes, especially in diabetic ulcers, these wounds just are infested with bacteria, and this infection can go down to the bone, to the level of the bone, and the tissue can die off. Actually, I think there's about 100,000 people with diabetes whose wounds won't heal that eventually will need an amputation, and of course, you want to avoid that.
So how does the honey help in these instances when antibiotics don't work? What does honey do that can actually heal?
Honey is very rich in sugars. It's called an osmotic environment. It literally sucks out the water from the wound bed. And it actually helps to pull up the nutrients that are needed in where the wound is actually healing. And this also kills the bacteria. Bacteria need water to survive. And the honey actually helps to heal, helps the wound to heal in this process. There's another way that honey works. There's a specific enzyme that is actually produced by the bees that add this, and it's called glucose oxidase. And when this is put on the wound, it produces bleach, hydrogen peroxide, and this kills bacteria right away.
Does such a thing as medicinal honey exist?
There's a honey, a medicinal honey that's just been approved by the FDA. This is grown in New Zealand. There's a chemist that's been studying this kind of honey for the past 2 decades. It's called Manuka honey, and it's honey that is harvested from the specific Manuka tree that grows there. Apparently, this honey has some additional specific factor. It hasn't yet been isolated in terms of what it exactly is, but he's tested it against a variety of bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics, and this honey just seems to kill off these bacteria when he tests them in the laboratory.
And so what kind of success rate has been reported with honey treatment?
There are over 200 cases that are cited in the literature which have shown success when it's used, you know, as a last resort. And when you're looking at success rates and from a scientific point of view, of course, you want to compare honey to other treatments, to conventional treatments. And these types of very complicated trials have not yet been done. When you're dealing with specialists in the medical field, sometimes you come across cultural barriers, and honey has just not been something that's been used conventionally in the hospitals. It was used up until the World War II and then fell out of favor when antibiotics were being used more often to treat infected wounds. But there's definitely a lot of skepticism out there.
I would imagine part of the skepticism of the medical community would be the fact that there probably isn't a lot of money to be made in honey treatment.
Well, again, of course, you don't have the backing of a large pharmaceutical company that's interested in investing in promoting these clinical trials, which are very, very expensive. So, I mean, that's definitely a barrier to any alternative treatment.
Now, I've also heard that honey is being used in Iraq with burns. How's it being used?
Honey is a very efficient, cheap treatment in areas that are war-stricken or where there's been an earthquake, where you may not have enough clean water, and water is often used as an emergency measure when there's a burn. And when this is contaminated, of course, the wounds can get infected. And there's a clinic called the Smith Burn Gate Clinic, 1 hour south of Baghdad, where this is being used to treat children with burns, and they've had some very successful results.
Thanks a lot, Karen. It's very, very interesting.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Karen Dente is a doctor who also works as a journalist on medical issues. Raw milk is milk that hasn't been heated or pasteurized. Many think that the plethora of bacteria that raw milk delivers has real health benefits. But in a number of states, raw milk is illegal. California's always allowed the sale of raw milk, but things are about to change. I'll tell you more when Good Food returns. When you say the words raw milk, you can see people's minds engage in arguments already beginning to form. But when you listen to Mark McAfee, third-generation dairyman and owner of Organic Pastures Dairy, all you hear is the natural simplicity of his pro-cow environment. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Evan.
What is raw milk?
Raw milk is milk that comes directly out of the cow, unprocessed, whole, enzyme-rich, biodiverse, and unprocessed by man.
And how many dairies are left in California that produce it?
There's Claribel Dairy, which has been around since 1927, without incident, by the way. No pathogens or any illness associated with their little operation. And there's Organic Pastures Dairy. We've been around since 1999, and we've had 80 million servings and no illnesses or any pathogens associated with our products either.
See, I think it's really interesting that when you say the words raw milk, the first things that come up before issues of taste, why would we prefer it, is all of this information about pathogens. Why is that?
Because historically, raw milk has been, it's had some real checkered problems. You know, back in the 1800s, there was a real serious thing. In fact, it was called the milk problem on the eastern seaboard, where about 40 to 50% of the children every year would die when drinking this milk that came from brewery dairies. And a brewery dairy was a dairy located in a downtown area next to a brewery. The conditions were deplorable. The people were milking the cows into open buckets. There was no chlorine or sanitizers or hot water. There was flies everywhere. That milk was horrendously horrible. However, that was where the whole beginning of this bad message about milk began. And nobody ever talks about the Amish that had their raw milk out in Pennsylvania on rolling hills of grass, where the communities would drink that milk, and that was keeping people alive and sustaining health, and that milk was being taken to the Mayo Clinic to cure all kinds of problems and diseases. And that was the untold story of milk. So there's literally been a history of two kinds of milk, the milk that's been very unsanitary, that needs to be pasteurized, and the milk that's very sanitary, and now with advanced testing technologies, we can validate and verify that, in fact, there are no pathogens present.
Okay, so let's talk about, if we visited your dairy, what wouldn't we see in the dairying barns that we would see in a place where milk is pasteurized?
You're going to find a clean and green kind of set of conditions where the cows are in that green grass pasture that you don't see. You see it in the Happy Cow commercials with the Got Milk commercials, but it's really not the true set of conditions found on conventional farms in California, where you generally have a concrete floor that's washed with lagoon water, so it's washed and kept clean.
What is lagoon water?
Lagoon water is where all the wastewater from the dairy gets washed, the manure water, the urine, the cleansers. We don't have that at Organic Pastures Dairy because we don't have wastewater.
Let's talk about right now what's pending in terms of laws that may affect you.
Early in 2007, about 8 months ago, we believe that someone at CDFA, California Department of Agriculture, as a favor to the IMS, the Interstate Milk Shippers Organization, and the FDA, introduced 8 words into the Ag Committee.
What were these 8 words?
These 8 words, and not more than 10 coliforms per milliliter.
And not more than 10 coliforms per milliliter.
Right.
What is a coliform?
A coliform is a naturally occurring bacteria which is beneficial. There are some coliforms which are detrimental and pathogenic, but those bacteria are actually tested for currently, and we've never had one. Coliforms are essential to life. They are the roots of the immune system of the newborn child. The birth canal is filled with coliforms. You put coliforms into yogurt to cause fermentation in yogurt. Coliforms are essential good gut bacteria. And these bacteria are found in fairly low levels in raw milk, but they're there. What they want is those bacteria levels to be lower than what's allowed for pasteurization, and it's not possible to achieve those bacteria standards. It's literally impossible.
Let's say by some weird instance, a pathogen that is a bad pathogen is introduced into your raw milk. What happens?
We've done studies on that. There's a bunch of enzyme systems and lactoferrin and bacteria-based systems that actually are pathologic. They kill pathogens.
And this is all in raw milk. That
Correct.
Raw milk
Correct.
Is a living substance, has all this bacteria that naturally reduce pathogens. Now, when we're talking about these pathogens, in particular, which ones are we most concerned about?
Well, you talk about E. coli, O157H7, Salmonella, Listeria. Those are the three important ones. But it's very important, Evan, to understand that pathogens die when they are attacked by colicins. And colicins are released by coliforms. So coliforms actually have their own little bad guy getting rid of system. Colicins kill E. coli 015787 on site. The FDA has already approved actual methodologies based on that for bee safety. So this is well-known technology that's Mother Nature's wonderful pathogen inhibition system. And that's what's alive and well in raw milk that has adequate levels of coliforms. And these are the beneficial bacteria that the state does not want us to have in our milk anymore.
And do you think that it's because they want to wipe out all competition? Why do you think this has been added to the proposed law?
The FDA, acting through the National Conference on Interstate Milk Shippers, the NCIMS, has had it as a written policy for many years that they want to eradicate raw milk in the United States. We do know that they hate raw milk. So that's, I think, where it's coming from.
Thank you very much, Mark.
You're very welcome, Evan.
Mark McAfee's dairy is called Organic Pastures. He's based in the Fresno area. I've got a link to articles and his site that can help you get more informed on the issue. You might find him at our local farmers markets as well. Do you realize that shopping and cooking from the farmers market is all about California cuisine? We're so blessed in this state with our abundant produce and prolific growing conditions. The California cuisine that's talked about all over New York, Maine, and many other major food cities has in part two chefs to thank. Michael McCarty from the legendary Michael's Restaurant here in Santa Monica, and Jonathan Waxman, originally from Northern California, who worked his magic at Chez Panisse, Jams, and at Michael's. I've got them both here with me next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. It's not often you get to be in a room with two contemporary icons, but here I am with Michael McCarty and Jonathan Waxman, both creators of California cuisine, the fresh market-driven juggernaut, which seems to only now, 20 or more years later, be reaching every part of the country. The two are bi-coastal. Michael has his eponymous restaurants, Michael's, in Santa Monica and in Manhattan. Jonathan has Barbudo in New York, and West County Grill in Sebastopol, California. Welcome.
Thank you.
How you doing?
This is such an unusual occurrence. So let's go back to the beginning. The two of you had this pull to France. You both had this eye-opening experience. Being a young kid from California, I think it was probably even more eye-opening.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I went to Paris for the first time, I arrived on my birthday, November 15th, 1976, and all these banners there was a big party, and it was the Nouveau Beaujolais Day, and I didn't realize that. I thought it was like there was a festival on my birthday, so this is great. But, you know, it really blew my mind, and I knew no French. As Michael said, you know, Paris is a party place. There's things going on all the time.
And the 70s were unbelievable.
Really
unbelievable.
And I was very lucky. I lived with this photographer named Dick Balarian, and he was, at that point, one of the greatest fashion photographers in the world. So there was fashion models running around. It was a pretty heady, fun time.
So now you both come back. Michael finds this little broken-down, bungalow-y house and decides he's going to put a restaurant there, and people thought you were crazy.
Right. when I came back in late 75, in December of 75, I called Lois Dwan at the LA Times. And I said, Lois, who knows the most about food? Who knows the most about wine in the city? And she said that Jean Bertinu, the chef owner of L'Hermitage, was cooking probably the finest food in America in a modern sense. I was really primarily involved in ingredients in those days. You know, for Jean Bertinu, we flew in everything from France, from the Rungis markets. We started a duck farm. We grew quail with Francis and rabbits, and we made foie gras. And unfortunately, Jean got very sick and died. He got a brain tumor, and it was over. And so at that point, I found this site here. I'd been looking quietly, but I didn't want anything that was normal. Most of the restaurants in Southern California were run by Europeans, and they were dark. The windows were closed. There was very little light going in. Virtually nobody ate outdoors. And so it was very unique to find this place. And one day in marches this guy named Jonathan Waxman.
And what were you cooking at that point, Jonathan? What were your interests at a time when you couldn't get parsley in the supermarket? You couldn't get Italian parsley in the supermarket. There was no fresh basil.
Well, I was very lucky because I grew up in Berkeley. And in 1971 or 72, these guys started rebuilding this wonderful little brown shingle building on Shattuck Avenue, which turned into Chez Panisse. And, you know, one day when I was looking for a job in 1977, I walked in and filled an application with Alice Waters, and she met with me and didn't hear anything for a couple months. Then out of the blue, she calls me up and said, okay, I want you to come do a little test dinner for me. And I think it was one of the worst dinners I probably ever cooked in my life. But she was very polite. And later on, she told me what really got to her was my handwriting, which is atrocious. And I couldn't figure out what she was talking about. And so she hired me because Mark Miller was going on vacation. She was a little desperate, to be honest with you. And I was the most likely candidate. But you know, what I really was looking for was not to be in a French restaurant. And not that Chez Panisse was a French restaurant per se, but it was, at that point, it was still kind of, you know,
very linked to Provence.
And, you know, Michael, here's a guy that wanted to cook things on the barbecue. I said, this is great. And I think that was, you know, where Michael's genius really shows through because he was unafraid.
I think we cooked every protein on the grill. I think we did.
But the other thing, too, is that people started bringing things in the back door. You know, a guy from Qantas shows up one day with John Dory from New Zealand. Right. Somebody drives down from Santa Barbara with Santa Barbara prawns. Things were happening. It was sort of mushrooming from there. And I think that was really kind of the, you know, the cornerstone of what, you know, what we're experiencing now.
So now let's fast forward to today. And Michael, you opened Michael's in New York.
Right.
So this experience of bringing California to New York, what is it like? Did you feel that you still had to push to open this audience up to a new level?
Not really, because, you know, the truth is during the entire 80s, everybody from New York that came out to California, to Los Angeles, ate in our restaurant, you know, the same industries, whether it's the Hollywood, the TV, the music, the book, the magazine. When we opened there, we were right between William Morris Agency and ICM, and CAA had their offices in the St. Regis. So it was, again, the whole combination, you know, which still is this way today. It's this mix of both the beautiful, you know, concept of what's L.A. and what's New York. We work sort of like an ethnic cuisine, no question about that. Green salad, oh, my God, what are you talking about? But, you know, it was embraced. I mean, we've been open now almost 19 years there.
Wow. Well, I have to tell you, this has really been a great pleasure for me to have both of you in here at the same time. And I want to thank both of you for agreeing to do it.
Absolutely.
You're welcome.
Michael McCarty is the owner of Michael's Restaurants in New York and L.A. He's got a new book out called Welcome to Michael's, Great Food, Great People, Great Party. Jonathan Waxman is chef owner of a restaurant in New York called Barbudo, and he's also author of a new book called A Great American Cook. I think last year was the year of the pig in the food world, but this kind of love doesn't end just because the calendar changes. I want to introduce you to a man who, along with his father and brothers, loves the pig. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. What would it be like to have deep roots? not just within a culture and a family, but within the French culinary culture of the pig. Stéphane Reynaud, owner and chef of restaurant Villeneuve-Trois, just outside Paris, grew up in the embrace of his grandfather's reverence for the pig. His book, Pork and Sons, is a huge, pretty book that's an homage to these intelligent creatures and the huge bounty they provide us. Now, I guess the place we have to begin is where it all began for you with your grandfather, Pepe Barbe.
Yeah.
Now, I understand he was a butcher, but more than that, it sounds like sort of every breath he took was about butchering the shop, the pigs.
You know, my grandpa was not a butcher. He was the butcher of the village. And I grew up with him, and he was a great guy for me because this man was an organic man, but a long time ago, you know, he was looking for the good animal for his butchery in Saint-Agrève, and for that he was looking for the good people to raise good animal. He always told me that to find a good pig, you have to find the good people. And I grew up with him in his butchery, and I learned a lot with him. And so it's why I wanted to write this book for my children, because they never meet my grandpa. And it was very important for me to explain to them how was the family in Saint-Agrève.
You know, it's funny. Here in America, when you tell people that there are souls out there who have a great love and reverence for animals, but who also slaughter them for food, mm-hmm. they don't understand this link.
You know, in France, in my village, we are very close to the animal. We love the animal. And it's the good way to have good food. It's to love your animal. It's not easy for me to kill a pig to do all the food with the animal. But if you know that the pig has had a good life before, it's more easy.
Now, since you were seven, you told us in the book that you've taken...
I remember, yes, when I was seven, the first killing pig, yeah.
And that's an important day. It's the annual day of the pig slaughter. Can you take us through the day and what that was like for you?
Yes, it's like a big fest in our village, because with a pig, you can have your own meat for the whole year. So each farm close to Saint-Agrève has their own pig. And they raise the pig during 1 year. The pig eats what the farmer produces, like potatoes, cabbage, everything. And then during the winter time, we kill the pig. So everybody's coming to the farm to help the farmer to do that. And we start to prepare all the food for the whole year. The salami, the ham, and all the sausages and such kind of stuff, and you put that on the fridge. On the, it's like a piggy bank. Then you have your food for the year.
Is it the same today? Do you take the same sort of festive atmosphere of the whole town?
It's completely the same today, because you know in France, and I think all around the world, people are afraid about the food because it's so. Industrial food, that they are very happy when they know where the food comes from.
Well, Stéphane, I want to thank you for producing such a unique and lovely book. It's just so much fun to sit and read.
Thank you very much.
Pork and Sons is the book that Stéphane Reynaud released last year. It's a book full of stories, wonderful recipes and photos. I highly recommend it. You can find info on today's show, watch the latest videos of Good Food, including the newest podcast on butternut squash lasagna, and hear past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Write me at goodfood@kcrw.com. Our executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano. I'm Evan Kleinman. Join me next week for another edition of Good Food.